If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. On these podcasts, we talk to guests who have experienced harm from extreme religious beliefs, as well as experts who offer help, hope, and healing. And sometimes these people are one and the same. I am your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our first episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. What we're going to do in this episode is set the foundation for episodes to come, starting with the introductions of ourselves as your hosts. So when you hear that silky smooth southern drawl from Bill Prickett, or my nonsensical diatribes about people who leave their Walmart shopping carts and parking spaces, you know a little bit more about what makes us tick. So in today's episode, Bill and I are going to interview each other, and we have known each other for around, I believe, 4 years, has it been?
I think so. I think both on Facebook and then in real life.
Yes. So we have become the president of each other's fan clubs, and we did a little consulting gig for Southern Poverty Law Center 2015. I think that's when we really connected.
Yes.
And since then, we have been inseparable. Or inseparable.
It's a combination of both, I'm sure.
It could be a combination of both, right. So after our riveting interviews, Bill is going to talk about what recovering from religion is about, who it's for, and where you can go for help with your questioning process. And then lastly, I'm going to talk about some upcoming topics for some exciting shows that we are currently working on. Now, I do want to say that this podcast is a work in progress. It is going to change and morph and grow and as we go along. So if you don't like something that we said, just hang in there because likely we'll say it again. We do want to make the show informative and interactive as possible for the podcast, and we look forward to hearing from you. And Bill will tell you later in the show exactly how to do that. Bill, I am very glad that you are here with me.
I'm equally glad. I'm very honored to be a part of this and the organization Recovering from Religion, and always to be with you on any project.
That is very, very kind, Bill. And I appreciate that as well. In the middle of our love fest here, tell me something. Tell me something that most people don't know about you.
Something most people don't know. That's okay. Well, some of it I can't tell because I was paid $130,000 by a New York lawyer to keep quiet. Okay, here's one. I worked the ropes at Studio 54. Most people do not know that. Unless you think I'm really, really old, real quickly, I'll tell you that about 15 or 20 years ago, the MGM Grand in Las Vegas opened a nightclub, and they called it Studio 54, and it was patterned after the original in New York City. And I was part of a nonprofit organization, and we had an event, and we used Studio 54, and I was up front working the ropes. And I got to tell people when they could come in, and I could tell them when they couldn't. And I even got to tell one person, I'm sorry, you can't bring her in with you. I don't care if she is your niece. She's too young.
How do you decide? We all want to know, how do they decide who's in and who's out?
Well, in reality, I had a big, huge bouncer standing next to me. But most in this situation, it was all about age. And so you had to be 21 to get in. And in that one instance, the man came in and had this very pretty woman with him. And when I wouldn't let them in, he said, but she's my niece. And I wanted to say, yeah, I've heard that before.
Right.
This is Vegas. Go away.
Wow. Interesting. All right. So you do go back a little ways because I know that you grew up in the civil rights era as well. And that's an interesting lead in to your story.
Yes, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, and I grew up during what many consider to be the height of the civil rights movement in Birmingham, which is like one of the epicenters of the movement. And I was there during the riots in the 60s. I remember the bombing of the Black Baptist Church. My freshman year in high school was the first year of forced desegregation and the first time I went to school with Black students. So it gave me a front row seat to a lot of what was happening.
How did that color your view of the world growing up? Because you were very young, of course, in high school back then, what, 15 years old?
Yes. Yeah. 13, 14. Yes.
So how did that impact you?
Well, I was raised with a very racist father. So in the culture, it was there. I can remember some businesses who would not allow black people to come in. My father worked for a restaurant, and there was a sign on the side of the restaurant that said colored, and that's where the black people would go to order their food. It was a fast food type place. They couldn't go into the restaurant and order. So I remember seeing all of that. And then when I got to high school, it was the first time I had been in school with black students. But about middle ways through high school, I was on the school newspaper staff and I was editor. And I was put with a group of people. We were called the Interracial Harmony Committee, just trying to find ways to make everyone's experience more comfortable. And so it was my first time to be able to interact with black students who were feeling displaced. They were feeling unequal. They were feeling oppressed. And I got to hear their stories up front and up close. And it was very impactful to me. And it did color my perspective and my perceptions for later when I myself would be involved in civil rights and equality in my own life.
How were you treated by the students being a part of that group where you're trying to make everybody feel comfortable?
You know, it wasn't too bad. I mean, I know that later after we graduated, things got even more tense in our high school. But I think that because it was so new, we wanted to understand. I know in our group, in our little committee group, we wanted to understand. We wanted to hear from each other and try to help one another. So I don't remember getting a lot of flack from people. I do remember, of course, there were those who would make comments. I remember teachers who quit because they refused to teach black students. It was an interesting transition time for me in my worldview.
But you were not raised in a Christian home per se. How did you eventually end up in ministry?
No, we didn't go to church growing up. After high school in college, I was invited by my roommate to visit his home church. They were having a holiday musical drama presentation. And since I had a theater background, he asked me to come and kind of help out. And so I did. And that got me involved in the church. One of the nights that we were doing a performance, I had just a profound, whatever you want to call it, conversion experience. It wasn't emotional or it wasn't even public. It was very quiet. It was very private. But for me, it was very transformative. And after that, I got invited to a Bible study group that was extremely fundamental in ways that are unimaginable now as I look back. And that was my early training in the Bible. But in that group, I began to teach and share. And everybody said, you need to go in the ministry. So I felt that way. And that's how I decided to pursue a career in ministry. But I left and went to a Baptist college, a Southern Baptist college, and got my training in college and seminary there.
And when you got into ministry, you got in deep. You were working for some pretty hefty names back in the day.
Yeah, because I began to become prominent in several areas. One of the skills I seemed to have was I'm very organized to the point of being obsessive compulsive. And I was asked to help organize a Billy Graham crusade. So I was put on the committee and I helped organize, and it kind of got me a reputation with other evangelists, nationally known evangelists, and they began to ask me to help them as well. And I worked with James Robinson, continued to work with Billy Graham, also worked with Phil Gothard and the Institute in Basic Youth Conflicts. I worked with an evangelist whose name was Bob Larson, very well known at the time. So I just kind of got a reputation for helping people plan. I would train the counselors, those people that when they give the invitation at the end and say they're counselors, here who are waiting to talk to you, I trained those counselors.
But you had a secret.
Yes, I did. I had a secret that I had known for most of my life, and that was that I was gay. Early in my experience, from the time I was 12, all of my sexual experiences were with other boys. I didn't know any other thing. I didn't have a name to assign to it. If you asked me, I wouldn't have said I'm gay or I'm a homosexual. That's just how my experience was. And I think for most of the boys that I was messing around with, for them, it was just messing around. But I always knew that it meant more to me. There was an emotional attachment to it. And that continued through high school. And then when I got involved in this fundamental Bible study group, they let us know very quickly that such behavior, such feelings were wrong. They were sin. So even as I went into the ministry, I felt like that if I worked hard enough, if I believed hard enough, if I memorized enough of the Bible, and I really did, I memorized entire books of the Bible, if I prayed enough, I would eventually overcome these feelings. And of course, I felt like if I got married, I would overcome these feelings. Eventually, I began to seek out what was known at the time as ex-gay literature, people who said they had once been gay and now they weren't. So I began to read the books. Then I began to go to the seminars and workshops, and once again, kind of rose to prominence. We started our own ex-gay ministry as part of my church. And so I began to speak and be on radio and television, sharing my own personal story of transformation. But I knew inside that it still wasn't a reality to me, but I was trying very hard.
Can you explain the emotional conflict that you felt, and how did you start to even process that and get out of it?
Well, it was an emotional conflict because I would hear people give their personal story and talk about they were once gay and now they weren't, and they did this and this and this. And so if I wasn't doing that, I'd start doing that. I wanted to change. And so I kept saying to myself, it's working for them. Why isn't it working for me? I need to try harder. I need to work more. I need to believe more. And so it was a constant conflict inside me of what I knew was supposed to be right, what I was told was right, and yet what I was feeling inside. I would go through periods where I may sublimate it enough that I didn't think about it for months, but then it would come raging back in the form of a dream or some cute guy walking down the street with no shirt on. Something would happen and it was all back again. So it was a real source of conflict, and I felt while people were looking at me as some success story, inside I felt like such a failure. I wasn't intentionally lying to people. I was saying what I was wanting to happen, which is how we were told we were supposed to do it. Say what you want, not what is reality. Say what you expect to happen. Faith is the things hoped for. So I would continually say, you know, God is healing me. But there was an impatience inside on why it wasn't happening.
So you were in ministry for what, 25 years?
Yes, from youth ministry in college all the way through a senior pastor of a Southern Baptist church in Birmingham, Alabama.
And when you started to process the gay feelings and your now fundamentalist background, how difficult was that for you to walk away from it?
It was very difficult. In fact, I don't know that I would had it not been for a couple of crises that happened. A dear friend of mine who I'd gone to seminary with came out to me after he left seminary. He finally told me what happened. He just couldn't do it. So he left and came out. We stayed close. I would travel because I was traveling on the speaker circuit by then. And I would go to, he lived in Dallas, and I would go to Dallas and we would meet up. We'd have dinner, we'd talk, and we stayed friends. And one night he called me and he was really in a bad place. And we had company at the time. And I said, well, Russell, let me call you tomorrow and we can have time to talk. And we hung up the phone and he killed himself that night. And I just, I was emotionally wrecked by that. And then not long after that, one of the guys in our ex-gay group was diagnosed HIV, was actually diagnosed with AIDS, full-blown AIDS. And when he told his family, they were so condemning. And he felt such shame at that, that he withdrew. He would not come to church. He wouldn't allow me, his pastor, to see him. And he died believing that he was shameful, that God had given him this disease as a punishment. And the two of those together made me question everything. I thought, we're doing this wrong. Something is wrong in this. And I just, I'd been there 11 years. The church was growing. It was very prominent, but I just burned out emotionally.
So what happened from that point?
I came to the place where I realized this is not working. It's not working for me. I don't know that it's working for anybody else. I resigned my church because I didn't want to live a lie. And because at that place, at that time, I knew I'm lying. I'm lying to myself and then subsequently lying to others. So I resigned and said, I don't want to do this. And shortly after that, my wife and I separated, and I was in a small apartment, a one-room apartment by myself, and I was just in despair. And I went that day after work, I bought a bottle of bourbon, and I drank about half of it, and I was sitting in my living room with the bottle of bourbon in one hand and a pistol in the other. And I had decided that there was only one way out. And I just remember shouting into that empty room, I'm done. And in my head, it was, I'm done living. But it was more, I'm done lying. But somewhere inside me, there was this assurance, a voice, whatever you want to call it, an intuition that I was not done. So I made a decision then to try to put my life together and be honest, to live openly and transparently.
So you kind of did an about face at this point.
Yes.
With everything. And
yes.
you shut down the ex-gay ministry. You left the church.
Yes. Yes.
That you were doing. And so what have you been doing since then?
I left Birmingham. I took a job in Southern California, got involved with another Bible study group of predominantly gay and lesbians. And then I've spent the last 30 years speaking out against these ex-gay groups, conversion therapy groups. I have been speaking out about the dangers and the damage that they cause, because I know what it did to me. I know how long it took me to recover from it. I've lost at least two friends, not counting those that I talked about earlier, but I've lost two friends who were just so depressed, not being able to change, that they ended their life. And so I've made it a kind of my mission to speak out and expose these groups.
And you even write. So I'm going to talk about your writing for a bit. So you and I, even though we're both writers, your path is very different than mine. And so we have this discussion going on. So I know you write fiction books, which I call books of lies.
It's part of my nature. So, I learned to lie very early.
Yeah. I know you went to Bible school. Talk about your books. Talk about what you do with that and your blog and how you reach people that way.
I've been writing since high school. The first, my freshman year in high school, our teacher assigned us, it said, I want you to write a short story using a part of grammar. That sounds so dull, but I picked hyperbole and I wrote a little short story about it. And she liked it so much. She had it published in the school newspaper. So that was kind of my start. And I've been writing since then. These days, I am a blogger. I blog often. I blog about whatever's on my mind. I blog about politics. I blog about religion. I blog about the unholy union of religion and politics. I write about being gay. I write about the ex-gay world and the deception and dangers. And yes, I write fiction. I've written three novels, working on another, and a lot of what happened in my life comes out in these novels. All of them are set in the religious culture of the Deep South. They're not religious novels, but they take place in a religious culture. My first one took place in a Southern Baptist church. My second one involved parents who were Pentecostal televangelists. So I write about religious culture, and people living their lives, trying to live their lives and make decisions in the confines of the strict religious culture of the Deep South.
And I have to say that what I've read, and I did read one of your books. I know, again, an ongoing discussion, as I usually only read nonfiction books, but I read this one and it was fabulous and I enjoyed it. And it was different than what I had expected, because you dealt with a lot of different topics within this, and you don't shy away from things like gay sex. I mean, that was the opening scene, the opening captivating scene. And then it goes on to there to talk about, I'm not going to tell what's in the book, but yeah. It goes on to talk about other things that are of you know,
yes,
I don't want to say much larger importance or kind of the more significance of where you started with the book.
Yeah, it's a fantasy story. It came out of a discussion I had with a friend of what if AIDS had never happened, and so I set the story, and it's kind of a cross between It's a Wonderful Life and A Christmas Carol with a little bit of Wizard of Oz thrown in, and it's fantasy. And writing sex is very difficult for me. I struggle with how much to put in. I don't like being graphic. I like being descriptive, but not graphic. So it's an interesting struggle, but it's still about these questions of making decisions when we're influenced and impacted by the religious culture around us.
And I would say that you live your mission. Knowing you, you are entirely one person who says exactly what he feels and thinks, and you live your mission.
It gets me in trouble.
Of course it does.
But now you're very different. You whereas I didn't grow up in church, you did grow up in church, correct?
I did grow up in church. I grew up in the Pentecostal Church of God, as a matter of fact. So we lived, ate, breathed all of the hype and emotion and experiential faith of my father's. That was such a normal part of my life that I remember we lived next to this Catholic family, and I went to a Catholic wedding for the first time. And it was the most bizarre experience because, you know, they weren't Christians because they were Catholics, right?
Yes,
that was the line of thinking. But then later on, we went to a Baptist church, and I remember when the pastor said, "Now let us pray." And he was the only one praying. And I thought, that's bizarre. These people, are they saved? What's going on with this? Because I was always surrounded by all that emotion.
Yeah, yeah. And often in these, in various denominations, especially in the fundamentalism, there is this exclusivity of we are the only ones, or we are the best ones. We are the right ones.
Yes.
And there is this mentality that does look at that, look at others in that way. And it reinforces our idea of how special we are to God.
Yes, exactly. Because we have the relationship and they have religion.
Yes, yes. And so we do talk about, you know, I'm not religious, I'm a Christian. So
exactly.
And we said that. I said that, you know, myself early on. Now, you also, even being in the ministry in a Pentecostal church, it's hard to believe, but even in the Pentecostal church, you had your own secret.
I did. I actually started in the ministry at age 15, but I was a gay kid growing up in a Pentecostal home, and there was no connection to what that was. I thought that it was something that would just go away, that it would fade away, and I was kind of a late bloomer. So when I realized I was gay at about 14 years old, I didn't tell anybody. I just held on to this secret for the next 5 years. And I, like you, I prayed and I read the Bible and I memorized scriptures and I pleaded with God and I cried, and it still wouldn't change. And so after going through all of those years of just pleading and praying and crying, and even at one point going to the pastor who decided to see if he could cast the demon out of me, I had heard of ex-gay ministry, which at that point, Love and Action was the premier ex-gay ministry in the country. And I started corresponding with Love and Action, which was based in Centerville, California at the time. They took me in into a one-year residential program, and I thought, this really is my last hope. Attending the program, and a lot of people ask what it's like to be in a residential program, because here's the scenario is that in our house, we had 12 young strapping gay men in one house, 2 to 3 to a bedroom, and it sounds like the perfect setup for something.
It's just like the perfect setup for a porn film.
Yes.
I've always thought that, you know, even in my involvement with ex-gays, I always thought, how do residential programs work?
Right. And looking back at my age now, it's very disappointing. But back then, we were there because we really believed that this was our last stop. We believed that God was going to fix us. He was going to change us. And the idea of being healed and having marrying a woman and having children and doing all of the quote unquote normal things that families do was very appealing to us, because all of these guys at one point or another, wherever they found themselves in life, were trying to do the right thing. They were trying to serve the Lord. They were trying to pull their lives together. And this was the last hope for us. For me, being in the program about 4 months in, because you're with all these people all the time, and I was scared to death, I didn't know what being gay was about. The only thing I'd ever heard about it at the age of 24 was that you got AIDS and that it just led to this path of death and destruction. You could never actually fall in love, because love was not a thing between two people of the same sex.
Yeah, it was lust.
It was lust. Yes. It was only lust.
Only lust.
So about 4 months into it, I had no sexual feelings at all. And I think part of it, a majority of that, was because there was no place to act out. We weren't watching porn. We weren't watching TV. We were almost never alone. There was no place to act out. And so I felt like I was being healed. It was better to have no sexual feelings than to have gay sexual feelings. After my 1 year in that program, and a lot of what happened in my program was, it was a lot of Bible reading, it was a lot of praying, it was a lot of accountability, it was men, straight men that came in to say, this is how straight men are supposed to act.
Yes.
And we somehow would just pick that up and that would become a part of us.
The modeling behavior.
The modeling behavior, right.
Yes.
At the end of my year of the program, I went to John Smith, who was in the director of Love in Action, and I said, I would like to go back on staff. I'd been in ministry for almost 10 years at that point, so I had a break with Love in Action. And John said, well, we have a lot of things going on in the ministry right now. We were just talking about someone that could come in and help us pull the program together, because we have media contacting us and we have churches contacting us. So I became the outreach director for Love in Action at a time when the religious right and the LGBT groups were really starting to battle. So we ended up finding ourselves all over television, staff members that went on Oprah Winfrey. We had Good Morning America. They were constantly coming to the ministry and interviewing us and talking about our message, which was freedom from homosexuality through Jesus Christ. And I believed and felt like this is exactly where I was supposed to be. It felt like magic. It felt like all of these things were culminating to that place in my life for everything that I had worked for, where we were now really on the cusp of something much bigger than ourselves and the ministry. And living on this high for so long, I still felt sexually attracted to the same sex, but I could push it down enough to where I felt, as long as it was submitted to God, that it would take care of itself and I would continue to grow and change. I got married at that point, and we moved to Memphis with the ministry. She was very unhappy in Memphis, Tennessee. And shortly after we got married, I actually exited the ministry, but I stayed in Tennessee for a few more years and became a minister at a church. From there, we took another position in Sacramento and moved back home near our families. And that's when things started to fall apart for me, because she decided that she was done. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to be married anymore. And in the Assemblies of God, where I was at the time, it's one thing to be gay. It's another thing to be gay and divorced.
And divorced, yes. I had that in the Southern Baptist as well.
Those were the nails in the coffin. But instead of giving up, I went at it for 6 more years. I threw myself even harder into the church, even after she left, and I tried to submit my life to God. And I did everything that I had been doing insanely for all of those years, which was just a repeat of the Bible memorization and prayer and accountability and fasting and crying and pleading with God to do something with my life. And now it was the divorce that got me. It was a divorce that said, this isn't right. I've done everything right. I've been praying for her with my concern and going into spiritual warfare and pleading with God. And I thought, where's God's responsibility? Where does God step in and say, all right, I'll take it from here?
Right.
You know, and where's her responsibility, where she's going to do something? So I thought, well, if God cares more than I do, then why am I doing all of the work?
Yes.
So those are the questions that were going through my mind. What had happened, I was working a secular job. I was actually a trainer. And a supervisor of mine said, I needed to do an employee review, and one of the questions on that review was, how are you going to improve your skills? The only thing I knew about improving skills would be to get more training or to go to school. So I already had my associate's degree, I'd been to Bible school, and I said, well, I'll go back to college. He was very much into college and education. He said, great. Before I could ever finish that statement, he already had a reference letter signed in hand. And I chose a college. I was traveling at the time. So fortunately, online schools were picking up, and I picked one of those to finish my degree. And while I was working on my undergraduate degree, my mind just started to open up. I started getting questions answered that most of those questions I didn't really ask. You know, it was related to the degree, and I didn't care that much about it. But I remember sitting one night in the embassy suites after traveling, and instead of watching television like I used to do, I was working on my homework. And that particular night, I was very depressed. I was very lonely. I was thinking about my children at home, wondering if they were okay, wondering what happened. How did I go from all of these national news events and things that we were doing to sitting alone in a hotel room where nothing made sense anymore? And I remember working on this assignment, and I looked at the search bar on the top of the screen about to type whatever it was I was looking for that night for the assignment, and I stopped. And I thought, that's not the question I want answered. The question I want answered is, where the hell is God? How did I get here? And what happens next? And it was the beginning for me of throwing myself into this education that I needed to know. I'd always been analytical, and I'd always been the one who would stand in the pew and speak in tongues and raise his hands. But the other side of my brain was questioning, why are we doing this? What does this really mean? Are those really words that you're saying? So it was always this dualistic thing happening for me in church. After I finished my undergraduate degree, I signed up for a graduate program in education, and I went to graduate school still believing that homosexuality was a learned behavior, because that's what I'd been taught. I didn't know any different. But when I got there, I started studying cognition, how we think, how we believe, how we learn, and transformative learning, meaning that you're moving from one thing to the other. And it was at that point that I realized maybe this is just part of my biology. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, and if I've been wrong about that, what else have I been wrong about? So brick by brick, I began to dismantle everything that I believed to be true about God, about my life. I'd already lost my marriage. I'd lost my ministry. I was working a secular job that I wasn't particularly crazy about, but it was paying the bills. And I started to take things apart. So that was the first time that I really questioned and thought, maybe God doesn't exist. Maybe there's more to this. But I got very, very angry.
Yes, I remember that. I appreciate that you changed directions and with your degree, your master's degree, you've got those fun little letters after your name. But you literally changed from the ministry and you got your education and went in a totally new direction.
I went in a new direction, not really knowing where I was going. All of these feelings I had about XK ministry, actually in my resume, it ended when I left Love in Action. When I had that resume as outreach director for this ministry, I took that off my resume. So it looked like I was about 25 years old because I had no, I just left off that whole ministry part, all those years I'd spent in ministry. I was just so ashamed. I felt like I had failed. I felt like that all of that part of my life was for nothing. It resulted in nothing but failure. Yeah. So I held on to that for several years, and eventually I started to reconnect with John Smith and some of the people from Love in Action in our old ministry group. When we were talking on the phone, there were some apologies given and forgiveness given. And so that reconnection helped me start to deal with the shame. And I know a lot of them were going through the same thing that I was, is just trying to find out who I was at this point without the ministry and looking at the possibility of life as a gay man and what that actually meant. But it was around 2012, actually 2013, I had to look this up, that the Lisa Ling special came on that I know that you were supposed to be a part of.
Yes.
And it was a group of people who had gone through ex-gay ministry like I had that were going to talk to Alan Chambers, who at that point was the executive director of Exodus International, the umbrella organization for ex-gay ministries. And they were angry. And so Alan was asking for forgiveness, and these people were sharing their stories and very similar stories to the life that I was living. Now that my wife was gone, I'd gone through divorce. Fortunately, I still was able to have a very close relationship with my kids. I didn't lose them like some of the other people did. But while we're watching the show, I was sitting with my then boyfriend, Abel, and I was so moved by their stories, I could barely contain myself. And I would pause the show sometimes to say, oh, well, let me explain to you what this is, Abel. So I just had a chance to breathe for a minute. And at the end of the show, I knew that I had to make a choice of either shutting everything down and going back into this life of shame and depression and trying to deal with what had happened, or I could move forward with my life. And I sat there and I made a conscious decision that I was going to move forward.
And one of the ways that you did that, that means a lot to me, is you wrote your book, Going Gay. I think I've told you this. I've read a lot of books by people who came from our similar background, but yours was so powerful to me, the way you told your story and what happened to you.
I tried to tell the story from the perspective of being in that position at that particular time. So one of the more poignant stories I tell is I remember going to get tested for HIV, and I'd never been in that situation before. When I was in the ministry, we talked about those poor people who couldn't control themselves, and these are the things that happen when you sin. And I knew I had practiced safe sex, but it was still in a place I never thought I would find myself. And when the person who's doing the test says to me, I need your consent, because if you have HIV, we need to know if it's okay to report this to the, or let you know that we have to report this to the CDC. And in that moment, I had two hats. I had my conservative Republican hat on that said, absolutely, you have to report this, because if there's a health crisis, everybody needs to know this. That's only fair. And then there was the other hat that said, this isn't about the Republican Party. This is about you. This is your life. What does this feel like to sit in this situation knowing that what's happening to me, this humiliating part, or what could have been this humiliating experience for me, now goes public? Is this where I find myself after all these years? Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the book to talk about each experience. I wrote the book to talk, and it's very judgmental. There are points in this book that are very judgmental, and I did that on purpose. In fact, I think one of the editors said to me, do you really want to have this in there? You know, you used a phrase that, I don't know what phrase it was I used, but something that was derogatory and homophobic. But I did that on purpose because I wanted to explain that that's what I was like at that moment in time as I went through the process. I was going gay. But writing the book was so cathartic for me that at the end of it, I found myself thrust in a new spotlight where I was talking about what reparative therapy was like and talking against conversion therapy. I was now working with John Smid at a conference where we were apologizing to people who had gone through conversion therapy and looking for ways to legally go out and stop this process that continues to plague our nation and especially our youth. And that was a big change for me. That was when I started to find what my passion was again after leaving all of those years in ministry. For me, I saw conversion therapy, and I still see conversion therapy, as the tip of the iceberg of what's wrong with fundamentalist theology.
Yes. And you've done the same thing by now you're writing a new book where you talk about, I mean, literally the title of the book is Reexamining Everything.
Rethinking Everything. Rethinking. Yes. Yeah. So Rethinking Everything, due out November 1st, is a book where I went back through. And after I'd written Going Gay, I started getting all of these letters from people, the Me Too letters and the letters from wives who said, you know, my husband was gay and I was blamed for it. Or my child was gay and I was told I was forced to make a decision between my child and my church. Or people later that I met, and just as I shared my story, they said, well, I went through a divorce. And when I went through that divorce, things suddenly changed on me, or I realized that things were not exactly the way that I thought they should be growing up in this faith. I mean, we're really promised the moon when we sign up for Christianity, because it's that abundant life. God will give you this abundant life as long as you're obedient, as long as you do X, Y, Z. And we find out that that's not really how it works. Life isn't always abundant. And sometimes the ideologies or the beliefs that we have simply don't match what's happening in our reality.
Yes. So we have to try to fit our experience around these things that we've been taught, because I'm like you, I was taught the abundant life. I spoke at churches where we were told, you know, just speak your disease away, speak your wealth unto you, and all of those things. And when our experience doesn't match that, there is such a disconnect in our lives, and we're made to feel like failures.
Yes. I think of the Mark Twain quote that says, a man is accepted into church for what he believes, and he's turned out for what he knows.
I think that's exactly true. And you've experienced it as I have. And I think that's one of the good things about this program and this organization is it gives people a safe space to ask questions, to express doubts. And I think that's what we hope to do in this rebooted version of the podcast.
You want to go ahead and talk about
that?
Talk about what the program is?
That was my segue. Recovering from Religion is an online community for those who maybe have experienced some of the damage and harm from extreme religion or extreme religious practices, as Tim has talked about and as I have in my life. We're not here to talk you into faith or to talk you out of faith. Tim has talked about coming to the place where he really doesn't know and doesn't necessarily see himself as a Christian. My journey was different. I still see myself as a person of faith. So we're not here to evangelize one way or the other. We want to provide a safe place for what you believe and where you are in your faith journey right now. We're going to have experts who can talk about faith, who can talk about some of the damage that religion can bring. We hope to bring some hope and some healing and some help for those of you who are listening. Recovering from Religion has a staff. We have on the website, you can find resources. You have people that will talk to you if you need to talk. We can hook you up with resources and therapists in your area. So we hope that you will use the resources that Recovering from Religion has. It's www.recoveringfromreligion.org.
Perfect. In upcoming episodes, we're going to talk about the areas of life that often swirl around our religious beliefs. So we often don't realize the extent of the decisions we make or the things that we believe that impact our lives on a daily basis. For example, I voted as a very conservative Republican for years after leaving the church without knowing how deeply ingrained fundamentalist religious ideologies had become as part of my conservative politics. Similarly, who we marry, where we live, what jobs we take, and even what we eat is often influenced by these deep-seated belief systems. So we're going to talk about belief systems that drive us and how we can become more aware of ourselves, our decisions, and our worlds in some of these shows to come. Some of the topics that we're going to cover are an inside look at the workings of the religious right. We have a guest that is ready to spill the beans on what life was like for her working at Focus on the Family's Family Research Council. We're going to talk about where evangelical Christianity came from, what religious trauma is, and how we can recover from it. How do you find passion after you leave the fold after years of church ministry? What it's like coming from a fundamentalist cult and what it's like to get out of it. So these are just a few of the shows that we're working on with many more to come. And we hope you'll stay with us as Bill and I learn the ropes and we make this happen.
Yes. Before we close, I want to give a quick shout out. Thanks to Craig Christensen, who composed the music for us. We appreciate that. We want to thank you for listening to this episode, our first episode of Recovering from Religion. If you have questions for either of us, if you have suggestions for future topics, or if you think you'd like to be a guest, your story maybe would help somebody. You can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks so much for being with us.